so we're going to talk about the disease states. Today, let's do some definitions first. Okay, what is bacteriuria?
Bacteriuria.
There's a good word for you. Okay. Can you use that in a conversation today?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I have this whatever it is.
Last night.
Did you read a different scripture?
I was just reading along, and I was like, Okay,
myelonephritis, what's that?
Kidney.
Infection of the kidney. All right. And that can be either acute or chronic. So acute, of course, there's no difference between acute and chronic. Is most of the time frame comes on rather suddenly, whereas chronic is longer lasting. But usually there are symptoms. Now, sometimes bacteriuria, I'll back up here to bacteriuria, sometimes it can be symptoms, or usually there are symptoms. But sometimes it can be asymptomatic as well, with no symptoms. Pyelonephritis, however, is more severe because it actually involves an infection of the kidney. So usually it does have symptoms, and the symptoms are usually more severe than they are with bacteriuria. We'll go through symptoms here in just a minute. Okay, what is cystitis?
Inflammation of the blood.
The gallbladder. There's no gall involved here. Is 905 too early for you?
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes. Okay. Depends on if you pull it all night or not. I see Alex isn't here. It's catching up to you. Okay. Prostatitis. Let's look at our diagram here. This doesn't show the prostate gland. The prostate gland is here. So in males, if that becomes enlarged, it can block the urethra, and that can lead to accumulation of urine or inability to void completely, and therefore bacteria can proliferate and cause a urinary tract infection. What's he speak?
So the prostatitis.
Prostatitis.
Is that just from cancer or?
No.
It can just get your inflamed skin.
As males age, it's really quite common for the prostate gland to enlarge. It's what we call benign prostatic hypertrophy, BPH. And it is not due to cancer. So what we have to do is use the PSA tumor marker to help us differentiate. It doesn't always differentiate, but to help us differentiate for benign conditions versus tumor or prostate cancer. But in any case, it will enlarge and close off the urethra, or at least narrow it. Urethritis is inflammation of the urethra. Okay. Now, the difference between relapse and reinfection.
Relapse is the same infection.
Relapse is the same organism. Yes. So after the patient has been treated for an infection, they get another symptom or another infection, recurring symptoms, but it's usually the same organism, which means it hasn't been completely cured. Reinfection, on the other hand, symptoms occur, but usually this time it's a different organism. So it's a completely different infection. And that suggests that the source of the infection remains. So whatever is leading to the development of these symptoms still is there. Okay, so that's the difference between relapse and reinfection. Okay, here's the typical symptoms with urinary tract infection. Frequency, meaning the urge to void frequently. What's dysuria?
Painful.
Usually painful. Because the nerve endings are involved in there through the inflammation in it. There's a little bit of pain involved or burning sensation. Nocturia?
Need to go and flush out urine.
At night. Urination. Urgency.
Gotta go right now.
Sometimes we have to avoid, but the sensation is there. Gotta go right now. Again, it's the nerve endings that are inflamed. Hurry up and wait, yeah. Hematuria.
Blood in the urine.
These ones, back pain and fever and chills. This usually is more commonly associated with pyelonephritis than it is with just a simple urinary tract infection. So the back pain is in the lower back where the kidneys are situated. So that's what you usually see. With chronic pyelonephritis, goes continues on for a longer period of time, you may develop scarring in the kidney, and so that can lead to additional problems. Malaise, you know, all know what that is. We're all suffering from malaise, right? Did you notice it was, well, it didn't snow here, did it? In Santa Cruz, I had 2 inches of snow. It was snowing out there. So I was going to say, prayers are answered. Continue to pray for rain and snow. It's good steady weather. At least till the 20th of April. Yeah. Okay, then the suprapubic tenderness, that's tenderness over the lower abdominal area, above the bladder. Pie urea. Okay, what's pie urea?
Pie
in urea.
White cell pie.
White cells in the urea. Okay, I emphasize this because that's the single best criterion associated with urinary tract infections. When we're trying to evaluate the number of organisms there. If pyuria is associated with it, then that's a good indication that there is indeed an infection. Okay, reasons for performing a urine culture. Why does the doctor order these? Well, obviously, if there is a suspected urinary tract infection, if there is blood in the urine or protein in the urine, one of my cats, my oldest cat, may have a tumor in her bladder, but we took a urine sample. That's what the vet asked. How'd you do that? Took it into the vet, and it was pretty grungy looking. There was definitely hematuria in there. Took x-rays, saw 2 little shadows in her bladder. No treatment, nothing to do for it. So, but now, I took another urine sample, actually, last night.
How? Like, put the bag on
her. You just stick the cup underneath.
How did you know?
This particular cat, is, she's my oldest, she's 14, maybe, around there. She's trained. When I put her in the litter box, I pick her up and put her in the litter box, she will go. If she has to.
So you just give her the cup.
So I just I put her in there and stick that underneath
it. Put the glove on.
What?
Put the glove on.
Question. Well, so my other cats won't do that, but she does that. So that's pretty good.
Have the kittens come?
Kittens haven't come yet. No. No. So I'm still waiting. And prostatitis, monitor catheter usage. We're going to talk a little bit more about catheters. Follow-up treatment, that would be for an already diagnosed urinary tract infection that has been treated. And then at the end of the treatment, they may or may not, they usually don't, but they could do another urine sample to see if there's any more organisms, see if it's okay. And FUO workup. Okay, what is FUO? Anybody? FUO. Bill.
I know what a UFO is.
Yes. This is FUO. Stands for fever of unknown origin. Yeah, fever of unknown origin. And so sometimes they just put that on the for the diagnosis because they don't know what it is. But the patient has a fever, so FUO, you probably see that quite frequently. So need to know, FUO. So one of the things that they will do is just include your analysis along with the laboratory tests that they might order. Okay, common sources of urinary tract infection. The 2 most common reasons why a person would get a urinary tract infection are, 1, hematogenous. So that means that there's an infection somewhere else in the body, gets in the bloodstream, and it travels to the kidney and sets up an infection there. Okay, so that's blood to the kidney, hematogenous. The other is ascending, meaning that we start out with a simple urinary tract infection or cystitis, and then if it's not treated, it gets worse, it can travel up or ascend the ureter up into the kidney. So that's ascending. And then a less common one, but one that can cause urinary tract infection, is obstruction. So if a patient has a stone, kidney stone, which can lodge somewhere in the kidney or maybe can travel down and lodge in the ureter or somewhere. That's a good focus of infection. That's something that the bacteria can adhere to and colonize instead of an infection. And then there are congenital abnormalities. This is mostly in children, young infants. They may have a narrowing of the urethra. They can do surgical procedures. They're really quite simple to correct these if it is just a stricture, which is the narrowing, or it may be something more serious. But those are the common sources of urinary tract infection, to bacteria and the more severe kidney infection. Okay, let's go on to prevalence. I'm just going to throw some numbers and data at you. You don't need to memorize all this stuff. The best thing to know about this is that 90% of urinary tract infections occur in females. So mostly in females. And the data suggests that up to 30% of females will have at least one urinary tract infection during their lifetime. 30%. Okay, increased frequency of infections during pregnancy, and that's usually because there's so much pressure on the bladder that the patient is unable to urinate completely, or completely empty the bladder, I should say. So that leaves urine in there. And it's a good culture medium, too, for more bacteria. And then recurrent infections. Some females will, throughout their lifetime, have recurrent urinary tract infections. They're treated, but they just pop up periodically. And there's some indication that it could be a genetic predisposition to, we'll talk a little bit more about that, to urinary tract infection. Okay, males, it's uncommon. Simple urinary tract infection is uncommon unless they have some kind of urinary problem, like an abnormal stricture or something that has not been corrected, or prostatitis, or stone. Okay, infants and children, 1% of male infants will have a urinary tract infection, but it's rare in females during infant. But in preschool, females, almost 5% of females will have a urinary tract infection in very few males. Okay, we do have some defense mechanisms that help us to help prevent us from getting urinary tract infections more often. One of these is high urine osmolality. What's the osmolality measurement? What's it measured? Concentration, yeah. How many particles are in this sample, the urine sample, or the concentration. So the more concentrated it is, the less likely organisms are to be able to withstand that osmolality. Low urine pH, so acid urine is helpful. Alkaline urines are more likely to have urinary tract infection. And the flushing mechanisms, that's the urination. So we've been told many, many times over and over again, drink lots of water, keep the kidney functioning, keep things flushing through there.
Why does cranberry juice help with this?
We're going to talk about that.
Okay.
There's a very scientific study we're going to examine. We'll get to treatment here and talk about that. Okay, I mentioned the other day not to have a catheter. You don't have to. Because of the risk of infection. So if you have a single catheter in one time, 1% of patients will develop a urinary tract infection. So 1 out of 100 will get an infection just from the catheterization. Long term, which means patients either during the course of their hospitalization period, or some people have to have catheters, if there's paralysis, for example, and they don't have functioning of the lower body parts, then they will have the long-term catheter, which is in there usually for the rest of their life. Catheters can be either open or closed. Open means that they're open to the air. The ending is open to the air. They don't usually do that anymore for long-term catheters because you can see that 90% of patients within 4 days will develop urinary tract infection. So they're used to close them off so that they're not open. But even then, half of the patients will develop an infection within 10 days. Oftentimes, this is a nosocomial infection. This infection is acquired while the patient is in the hospital, and they have to have prolonged catheter usage while they're in the hospital. Okay, here we go to the colony counts again. Let's talk a little bit more about the significance of these colony counts. These are general guidelines. And notice down here, first of all, We talked yesterday about this, 10 to the 5th number, or on Monday, I guess it was. The study, where these data came from was a study that was done back in the 1950s by a physician known as Kass, K-A-S-S was his name. And he developed these criteria. But in his study, he only examined Enterobacteriaceae. So this number, we usually say that if you've got greater than 10 to the 5th organisms, that's significant bacteriuria, significant infection. But it applies only to Enterobacteriaceae, and it does not apply to asymptomatic females. So patients can have an infection at lower numbers. It still could be significant, so we kind of have to look at the clinical history of the patient as well. Okay, if their colony count is less than 10,000, or 10 to the 4th, in a female, and again, we're talking mostly females here because 90% of infections do occur in females, it's probably urethral or vaginal contamination, meaning that the sample has not been collected properly, the area cleansed properly, so we've got bacteria from surrounding areas in there. Now, if it's in between these two, 10,000 to 100,000, 10 to the 4th, 10 to the 5th, then we have to evaluate on clinical information. So the laboratory will usually have criteria of when to evaluate. Evaluate means working up the organism and identifying it. So sometimes we will, sometimes we won't. Let's take a look at exceptions to the 10 to the 5th rule. Infants and children can have a significant infection with less or fewer than 10 to the 5th organisms. Males, especially if it's a catheter or a suprapubic sample, because there's not likely to be contamination in those samples, so fewer organisms are likely to indicate a true infection. If the patient has already been started on antimicrobial therapy, that's going to decrease the number of organisms that we get. Symptomatic patients, so if they have symptoms but they have fewer than 10 to 5 organisms, it still could be a significant infection. Symptomatic patients would be those that exhibit acute urethral syndrome. Oftentimes this is related to a sexually transmitted disease, but it has symptoms of urinary tract infection. So we'll come back and address that topic when we get into the genitourinary tract infections. 2 weeks. It's 2 weeks. Next week will be blood infections. Okay, so if the patient has symptoms, but they only have 10 to the 2 organisms, it still can be significant. And if they have concurrent pyuria. Now, how do we examine? How do we test for pyuria?
Dipstick
is one way. We can do a microscopic urinalysis and look for white cells. So it'd be greater than 5 white cells. We can even see them on gram stain. So there are different ways that we can detect the white cells in there. Okay, if the sample is not a first voided early morning specimen, okay, why would that have an impact?
It's
not as concentrated, so it probably would not have as many organisms in there, particularly if it's towards late afternoon or something, they come into the dock and they've been drinking a lot of fluids, it could dilute things out a bit. So that's why we prefer that first voided sample in the morning. And leukocyte esterase positive, okay, that relates to the pyuria, that's the dipstick method of detecting the white cells. Okay, what are polymicrobic samples or specimens? More than one organism. Okay, the urine again, it should be sterile fluid, except the outer part of the urethra, which is contamination, so we can't get other organisms in there. But if it's collected properly, we should have a pretty pure sample. Okay, with anaerobes, sometimes anaerobes can cause infection. With anaerobes, it's possible to have more than one type of organism. Neurogenic bladder, okay, that refers to patients that have paralysis of some sort. And again, they don't have body functions in the lower part of the body, so they can't control their bladder functions, and they will have usually the long-term catheter that's inserted in there permanently. And that's likely to be become contaminated at some point, and so it's not unusual that they would have more than 2 or 3 organisms. Okay, if there are urinary tract structural abnormalities, we've already talked about that. What we call contamination is usually three or more organisms. So we should not have that in there if it is a true infection. There should be one or possibly two organisms. But when you start getting greater than three, these are the things you should think about first. And contamination is probably the most common that you're going to find. Okay, now let's get to treatment then. One of the things the doc will tell you if you have a urinary tract infection is to drink lots of fluid, water primarily. Just drink water, 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 water. Let it flush through and get those organisms out of there. Okay, here's the cranberry juice. What does cranberry juice do for us? We usually think we could attribute it to pH, more acid urine. But here's a very scientific study. This was in the newspaper. This was back in 1994. The study backs cranberry juice as urinary infection fighter. Cranberry juice has long been the drink of choice among women with urinary tract infections, but urologists often have been skeptical. Now, a Harvard Medical School study, that's why it's a scientific study, Harvard Medical School, has given the drink a boost in credibility. 153 elderly women with an average age of 78. Is that elderly?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Were divided into two groups and given 10 ounces a day of either ordinary cranberry juice or a specially prepared synthetic placebo drink, indistinguishable in taste. Urine samples were collected every month for 6 months. Before the test, nearly the same number of women in each group had UTIs, but those who drank the real stuff tested positive for infection only 42% as often as those who drank the fake. The traditional theory is that the juice makes the urine more acidic and discourages the growth of bacteria. Not true, according to urology professor. You'd have to drink massive quantities for it to be effective in significantly raising the acidity. Drinking more liquids overall is commonly recommended by doctors who disbelieve the acid theory. What I tell my patients is to take increased fluids, primarily water, to flood the bladder to act as mechanical cleansing. The acid theory now has company. E. coli bacteria, the main cause of these infections, have tiny surface structures that enable them to hang on to interior tissue such as the bladder wall. What are those tiny surface structures? What do we call them? Fimbriae, okay, the fimbriae enable them to hang on to interior tissue such as the bladder wall because there are receptors on the bladder wall that the fimbriae can attach to. And that's why some people are genetically predisposed, some females particularly, and have urinary tract infections periodically throughout their lifetime because they have these receptors that bind this special strain. And it's not every E. coli, but certain strains of E. coli that have these particular fimbriae that attach to the receptors. So a group of Israeli scientists reported in 1991 that cranberry juice strongly inhibited the bacteria's adhesive ability in lab experiments. They found a polymeric compound of unknown nature in the juice that may be responsible. So it interferes with the ability of the E. coli, the fimbriae, to adhere or attach to the receptors. The compound is also present in the juice of the blueberry, one of the cranberry's cousins. So there's your genealogy lecture for the day. They recommend that clinical studies be done to test the juice's efficacy, hence the Harvard study. So there you go. That's what happens. So acidity probably has something to do with it, but according to this doc, you have to drink an awful lot of it to lower the pH effectively enough to inhibit, but it's mostly interfering with E. coli. So E. coli, then, is the most common positive agent that you mentioned that the other day. Okay, other treatment, antibiotics. Usually, they'll give antibiotics, and sulfa drugs have typically been the most common drugs that are given for urinary tract infections. Examples of the sulfa drugs would be Bactrim, Ceftra, Gantrisin. You may have heard of these. You are likely to encounter them probably at some point working in the lab. They sometimes color, especially Gantrisin, colors the urine so it looks like it's kind of orangish color. But those are just medications, and they're usually taken for 2 weeks, 10 days to 14 days. Other antibiotics are certainly effective, again, depending upon what the organism is. Once in a while, I'll give a single dose therapy. So they just give a big bolus of antibiotic one time only, but that's not very common. They usually just give it a routine 10 to 14 a day. Okay. When you get, you don't have to know all of this stuff, but this just shows you that there are some interpretive guidelines. And again, every laboratory probably has their own, but this will show us that if we have only 10 to the 2, a colony count is 10 to the 2, and if the patient does have symptoms, symptomatic female, if you're closer to examining the rods, we're going to identify it. We're going to work it up. So it depends not only on the colony count, but if it's pure and if they have symptoms. get down here, 10 to the 5th. If it's pure culture, work it up. But on this criteria, if it's greater than 2, just report multiple species present. They don't identify the organism. It's probably just contamination. It's garbage out, so we're not going to be able to report anything. So the criteria, the numbers, the 10th to the 5th, and that are good guidelines, but we have to look at some other things as well.
So for our urine this week, if we have, you know, 2 specimens, we can just say can't work enough.
That is not an option this week. Okay, everybody wait. I'm looking at everybody. Okay.
That's really cute.
All right, we're going to do some questions. Some cases. Does he like kids? You're training them well for like kids? Good thing. All right, tell me how we collect the sample. What type of sample do we want?
First morning.
Clean catch, morning urine. Okay. First morning clean catch, midstream. Okay, what do we do with it then? We get it in the lab?
Yeah, if it's cloudy, you're going to need it for instance.
If it's what?
Cloudy.
That's spinal fluid.
I'm not using it. Yeah, don't get those mixed up.
Yeah.
So, QA, check for white blood cells.
2 hours processing. What do we do with it before we start analyzing it? Is we have to analyze it within 2 hours or refrigerate it. So how long can we refrigerate it? That happens to a while. 24 hours. Okay. What media are we going to plate it on?
PEA.
Okay, so you know the uses then for McConkie. You know the uses for PEA. What's the substitute for PEA?
CNA.
What does CNA stand for?
Colistin.
Yes. Okay. It does pretty much the same thing as PEA, which is selective for gram positives. So, did you have any gram negatives growing on your PEA yesterday?
No.
Nobody did?
I did. I should have.
Well, look today, and you'll probably see a little bit more growth on that, but they're tiny, tiny. Those are the gram negatives that are trying to grow, but they're greatly inhibited. Okay, what's the plating technique? Let me see you do it. Some of you are better than others.
You can tell from there.
Okay, and the significance of the colony count. Okay, we've already gone through that, so just make sure you understand that. Need to know. And exceptions to the rule. Need to know. All right, here's a case. Pregnant, 32-year-old female complained of dysuria. This was her colony count using the small loop. SPA was 73 colonies, max 70 colonies. They were lactose fermenters and no growth on PEA. Okay, so is this significant?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's greater than
10-5.
Dysuria.
Is it greater than
10-5?
No.
What do you report out?
Yes.
What do you report out in terms of the number of colonies? What do you report out?
73,000.
Okay, that is less than 10-5. But is it still significant?
Yes.
Why?
Because she has symptoms.
She has symptoms. She's pregnant and she has dysuria. Lethal combination.
Pregnancy is a symptom?
Yeah, it's happening.
Yes.
Okay, we tested the organisms, oxidative negative. Psi was a ray with gas. In the reaction, model, LD negative. Okay, what are you thinking? Goes down that line of saturation or enterobacter, but the LD differentiates. Peter hasn't looked that up yet. Enterobacter, how do you say that?
Species?
Chloe. That's how I say it. And I may be totally off base, but that's the way I say it. Okay, so it's Enterobacter cloacae. Now, what does this look like if we just did the image?
Klebsiella.
Looks like Klebsiella, but what tells us it's not Klebsiella. Okay, so that brings us down to Serratia or Enterobacter, and then the LD helps differentiate those two. Okay, good. Here's another one. 165 colonies of blood, 140 colonies of non-lactose fermenters on the map. What are we going to report out? Still using the small one.
10.
Very good.
It depends on which loop. It doesn't say.
She's using the small one.
Oh, yeah.
I did say. It said. Okay. It was oxidase negative, K over A, H2S. Phenylalanine, deaminase positive. It was wearing a pink tie. And indole positive. Okay, now what do you think?
Rubidensia.
Rubidensia is a possibility? What else is a possibility? Proteus. We haven't done a whole lot with Proteus yet. We're going to look more closely at Proteus. Probably next week, I think. But the main thing is, we know it's K over A with H2S. Okay, there aren't too many that produce H2S. Proteus do, Citrobacter, Salmonella. But phenylalanine, deaminase positive, and urea positive puts it in the category.
Why did you do the phenylalanine? Because on the flow chart it says urea and indole for proteinaceous carriers. Those are the only two that it says you need to do that.
Well, I did it so we could talk about it. What does a positive PD look like?
Green?
How do we get it to be green?
Ferric chloride.
How much ferric chloride?
Five
drops. What percent ferric chloride? 10%. There you go. Okay. So you guys know how to do it. Yeah, you have to add those drops. We look for a... Usually, what I've seen is a very, very faint green, kind of a greenish-yellow we were on the slant. So hopefully, we'll see that today. Okay, another one. Same colony count. These are lactose fermenters. Same loop size. Here's your Klebsiella reaction. Now what are you thinking?
Klebsiella.
Okay, this one, we have 122 colonies on PEA. What are we going to report out? How many are we going to report? Okay. This is catalase positive.
I guess negative.
Staphylococcus, right. And that's a common urinary tract infection. Okay, let me say one thing before we go about doing Gram stains on uncentrifuged urine samples. Some labs will do it and some won't. So make sure when you go to the lab that you find out what the criteria are for doing Gram stains on uncentrifuged urine. Sometimes, also, sometimes the techs get kind of used to taking shortcuts. I'm trying to get you guys not to take shortcuts, but one thing they will do is if they culture the organism, they get a pea colony on command. They test the indole. It's indole positive. What's the first thing you think of? Pink on Mac, indole positive. E. coli, most common organism to cause urinary tract infections. That's all they'll do. They'll just call it E. coli. Now, don't you do that, okay? I'm just telling you that once you get experienced and you get to seeing these things, you know. And it really doesn't matter if it's E. coli or Enterobacter or Klebsiella. The treatment's all going to be the same. So it's really not that critical. If it were not E. coli, for example, but that's one thing that what you can look forward to, I guess, when you experience. Okay, that's it.
Can't they also use the sensitivity panels?